Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, a global nonprofit that seeks to put the rights of children before the desires of adults. So you're in for 1 hour of child-centric content, and you will be better, happier, and more courageous as a result. We always start things off here with a little bit of Bible time. And if you've been listening to the show for a few other episodes this year, you'll know that I am reading through the Bible chronologically with my 18-year-old son before he goes to school every morning. And we've had a lot of fun in Genesis. All kinds of life lessons are emerging from that text. One that came up as we were looking at Abraham and Sarah and Hagar is, it is really hard for a man to treat his children equally when they do not have the same mother. And you can hear that in the echoes of the biblical text, or oftentimes in the lives of the children around you who are suffering from divorce or remarriage or serial monogamy or whatever it might be. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm saying it's very hard. But something really cool happened. I read the Bible with my kids all the time. I've been doing it since they were really little. My husband is like Bible scholar extraordinaire. So like we've passed on a love for the word to them. But when we were reading through the account of Rebecca and Isaac, when they were going through the land, and he's like, hey, if anybody asks, you're my sister because you're really hot and I don't want somebody to like attack me and then take you. And my son goes, wait a second, that just happened. Like his mom and dad did that same thing. I'm like, yep, you become what you behold. You know, what you do in times of challenge very often is going to be patterned after, for better or worse, what your parents modeled for you. And he goes, no, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the same guy is the concern. They're concerned about Abimelech. Wasn't it Abraham and Sarah that were also concerned about Abimelech? And I was like, wait a minute. That can't be right, because you're talking about, there's no way the same Abimelech is alive. And he's like, go look it up, mom. So I skip back a couple chapters and he was right. It was Abimelech in both cases. So we got out our ChatGPT. We're like, ChatGPT, what is going on here? And it was like, New Testament scholars recognize that Abimelech is not the name of a king, but it is the title of a king, like Caesar. And anyway, I just thought, kind of like a bit of a pride moment for me as a mom, going, it's awesome when your own kids, when your teenagers teach you something, point something out in the word that you've never noticed before, even if you've read it, even if you think that you know it and you've read it 1,000 times, or not 1,000, but you know, 12 times. It was just awesome. Awesome to do it with my kid and have him be like, mom, how could you not catch this? And I'm like, good. Keep correcting me, baby. I love it. I'm here with my training director, Jen Friesen, who also is a fan of the Word of God. Jen, any fun scriptural epiphanies that you've had this year so far?
I can't think of anything off the top of my head, other than the offline conversation we just had about the genealogy of Matthew. So I'm going to be looking into that, because I was talking about how, to Katie, that I learned Rahab's son was Boaz. And then I was like, that makes sense, because Boaz cares for Ruth. Why would he have a special attention to Ruth? Well, because Rahab's his mom. And so Katie was just sharing that there's, like looking at the genealogies, there's some different understandings of, you know, what the timeline is and how that works, which is actually was blowing my mind offline of this conversation just today. So that's really cool. And I will be looking more into that. But I was just thinking too, off of what you were saying, I love reading the Bible with folks who are newer to it as well. And your kids have been reading the Bible also for a really long time, like you said. But I have some friends, and I worked in a youth organization where you would introduce folks to different stories for the first time. And it was awesome to read it or hear it again through the eyes of someone who had not heard it a million times. Mm-hmm. They are so often more receptive to seeing something fresh, take a fresh take from it, being open to what God's trying to teach them, because they're not looking at it thinking, I already know what it says, and okay, this is what it means, blah, blah, blah. And so I love that aspect of reading the Bible with all different kinds of people, different ages, different experiences in the church, because it continues to be fresh. It's living. Mm-hmm. It impacts us more, you know, every time we read it. And I've heard too, it's a good thing to approach scripture asking God, reveal yourself to me through this, help me to understand it. Because it's pretty arrogant to think I can just read it and I'll know what it means. And I'm going to, you know, I'm going to instruct people on what it means without the humility of asking God, help me to understand it today, even help it to be fresh to me today.
Yeah. My favorite way to read the Bible is with other people, to hear what they hear and what the Lord is teaching them. It's amazing, you know, that the Word of God comes alive and we are able to, you know, it really like finds its some purchase in our soul when we're discussing it with others and hearing it through their lens. Well, we want to turn our attention towards a story that caught our eye, and it was from the Institute for Family Studies on how recess is becoming too safe. Now, I am a Gen Xer, and when I remember the play equipment that was at the park that I used to go to, and I'll tell you what, it was dangerous. It was dangerous. It had one of those corkscrew slides, metal, of course. So if you're just burning your thighs when you go down in the summertime. But it had three different twists. And for the very daring, you could walk up the outside of the twist, right, with the feet on the bottom rung and the top kind of all the way up. But once you got to the very top, if you were to let go and fall down, you're going 20 feet. It also had one of those merry-go-rounds that didn't have any kind of like resistance to it. So if you got like the big sixth grader to push you when you were a 6 or 7 year old, you had some centrifugal force that would whip you across the playground. And that's exactly how we liked it, right? We wanted the swings that went that were so long that if you did choose to launch off the top, you are going to have to tuck and roll at the end, or you're going to break something. And I look back at that same park, I drive past it now, and it's just this sad, safe, lame play equipment that's awesome until you're 5. And after that, there's no adventure there and there's no risk to it. So we've taken this mentality of play needs to be safe, and that's trickling into schools as well. So Jen, tell us a little bit about this article from the Institute for Family Studies on what the research is saying and how that might be detrimental to children's developmental, physical, and emotional resilience.
Yeah, so it said schools across America are eliminating risky play from recess. So they're banning things like tag, jumping off the swings, climbing on the monkey bars, and all of it is couched, of course, in safety and adults feeling worried about them. But their research is showing, so the Institute for Family Studies is looking at the research, and it's showing that this is backfiring because kids need the risky play to develop emotional resilience, probably some physical resilience and some smart, you know, some common sense in some ways, right? And so the fear motivating people to prevent risky play might actually be creating more fearful and anxious children. And the author was arguing that our obsession with physical safety is actually undermining children's healthy development. I remember hearing a story too, that the way that they were making the ground of the playgrounds super soft and springy, compared, so it's like old tires and stuff now, recycled tires, very soft. I remember playing on the church playground growing up. It was gravel. It was the kind of thick gravel, or it was the wood chips. The problem was making it too soft, kids being able to launch from the top of the playground and hit the ground and not really be hurt at all, was then making it so kids were doing that in other areas, thinking they could jump 10 feet to regular ground and thinking it wouldn't hurt. And then they were in pain, versus a not as soft landing ground makes it so maybe you're a little more protected if you were to fall, but it's not designed to have you jumping from the top. You're supposed to learn, if I fall, I'm going to be okay. But if I'm jumping from the top, it's probably going to hurt, right? And so they started working backwards to make the ground not as soft. Isn't that funny?
I remember that era of cushy, springy foundations at like playlands and things like that. And I don't think that there's like a sanitary aspect as like wood chips, which kind of, anyway, like go with the natural option. I will tell you that ever since COVID, especially, I don't hate a lot of things, Jen. I hate it when people say, stay safe. Like, screw you. Safety is not the point of life. And if safety is your God, you will sacrifice. You'll sacrifice so much for safety. You'll sacrifice truth. You'll sacrifice flourishing. You'll sacrifice industriousness. Like kids need risk. They need appropriate age, like age appropriate risk. But if your goal is to keep your children safe, they will never leave your care. They'll never be outside of your protection. So the goal is, good parenting is age appropriate risks in all of these areas. Autonomy, right? The ability to walk to the store on your own when you are 8 or 9 or 10, depending on how far away the store is, to be able to take public transit on their own. To encourage them to jump off the swings sometimes. So this idea that safety is the governing model of how we need to orient ourselves and orient our children towards the world. I mean, why do you think that you still have some 28-year-old men that are living in the basement and, you know, playing video games all their life? Because they didn't have the chance to use an axe and cut firewood on their own when they were 9 or 10 or 11. I mean, like, that kind of physical risk is actually really important when it comes to children developing their own sense of, like, autonomy and ability.
Yeah. They drew an interesting, or showed something ironic as well, that the classroom has become increasingly permissive to disruptive and violent behavior. A kid throwing a fit, everyone else has to leave the room. And within the public school system, you're not allowed to touch them, or you have to, you know, of course, use very particular ways of restraining all these things. Maybe some of that is good. But I also saw something really interesting that talked about, this was connected to the ICE shooting. And it talked about how women who are identifying as men or as lesbians, but they've never been, they're not raised as boys. They're not punched in the mouth when they do something obnoxious. They're not forced to roughhouse and, like, defend yourself when you're doing something that's not socially appropriate, because it's not right to hit girls. But the problem is then they go and physically attack men, or they think it's okay to drive their car into someone. And someone said they're basically like 13 or 14-year-old boys that have never been punched by someone older and bigger than them when they're trying to be a bully to someone who's bigger than them. I thought that was really fascinating, that we're socializing kids almost completely inappropriately and upside down from what they need to be good, safe humans.
Yeah. A rejection of reality, whether it's the reality of the nature of a hard ground at a play equipment, or the nature of the reality that men and women do interact with each other differently. Men are not necessarily going to approach a woman in terms of physical aggression the same way. You know, we talked a little bit, I think, last week about how women communicate differently. Like, they tend to undermine, they tend to go behind the back door, they tend to, like, gossip or backbite, whereas men confront directly. And some of those norms, like, you know, there's this famous parable of Chesterton's fence, you know, where he talks about how if you're walking through a field and you suddenly encounter a fence, you're like, why is this fence here? Well, this is a total obstruction. This is an inconvenience. We should take this fence down. It's better to understand, why is there a fence there before you take it down? There's a real good chance that somebody put that fence up there for a reason. And some of those fences do have to do with, like, how do we allow kids, right? Where's the open gates for kids to go through? Where have we always allowed them to go and explore and play? And then where are the fences that genuinely involve, like, child protection or governing children's behavior, like in the classroom? There's a reason why we crack down on kids that are misbehaving in the classroom, because if you don't, and I'm saying this from years of experience of kids being in public school, you condition the worst behaved child to have the most power in the entire room. And that doesn't go well for anybody. It doesn't go well for the teacher. It doesn't go well for the other students. It does not go well for the child that never learns that there's consequences to their behavior. And that definitely is the case when it comes to playgrounds, when it comes to recess. There are consequences to the behavior, but those risks allow you to develop the right kind of breaks, but also lanes of acceleration, so that you can know exactly how to use your strength, how to use your ambition, and how to channel that aggression. Thanks for joining us on that fun little trip down memory lane. We're going to be right back with a few more stories about children and family. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
We are back at Them Before Us Radio. I am your host, Katie Faust, here with my training director, Jen Friesen. We're going to hit an item that comes up a lot in our work, and it has to do with, hey, if you guys defend children's right to their biological mother and father, how do you feel about adoption? So we got that again on social media this week. Jen, exactly what was the context for that question?
Yeah. I posted from your account that you are going to be a speaker at the Young Leaders Summit for Live Action, which is a pro-life group. That's the Lila Rose organization. So that's a plug as well. It's in March if you guys want to go hear Katie speak and you're a young leader. And someone commented on this post and said, no, you're going to have an anti-adoption speaker. Got it. You can't get any more pro-life than that. And then she said, sarcasm. And someone was like, who are you talking about? That's anti-adoption. And she was like, Katie Faust. And she said, basically, you only want to go be on the pro-life ticket to like grift the pro-life movement to be able to promote your anti-adoption rhetoric. And then what else? Let's see. I read one of her recent articles. She was attacking orphanages and mentioned how much profit they're making. Well, goodness, she needs to look at herself and the money she's raking in now, apparently. And why not look at the billions of money that's coming into pro-life population of organizations, Catholic Church? You're over your head, apparently. I was like, she asked if I've ever read your articles, which I was like, I work for her. I post your articles. I asked her what article she could possibly be talking about. I have no clue. And then she basically said, because of our focus on biology, anti-abortion groups, she's according to her, I'm like, well, I'm not in any, so I don't know, are always sharing our content. You've never said anything about birth mothers, I guess, and you've never said anything about adoption. And I said, also ironic, this was the same day we posted our article on Substack. You guys can go read the difference between adoption and third-party reproduction, because a lot of people will say, if you're against sperm and egg donation because they lose their biological parent, you have to be against adoption. And we said, no, here's why those are completely different. And it's the same day we posted this Substack article. So anyway, for the record, Katie, for everyone, because I'm going to clip this and I'm going to post it ad nauseum for people. Are you Katie Faust against adoption? And what's the Them Before Us position on adoption?
Am I anti-adoption? It's a mystery wrapped in an enigma because I've never talked about this before. I haven't been completely vocal about how I myself am an adoptive mother, about how I am the former assistant director of the largest Chinese adoption agency in the world, how I've gone on trips to and visited several overseas orphanages and seen really terrible, destitute conditions of children that are there, talked with and walked with so many families that are not just adopting white drug-free infants, but are going after the children that have truly been forsaken, the sibling groups, the older kids, the kids with special needs, the ones that nobody wants. And I'll tell you what, that is a just society's response to children who have lost their parents. That is what adoption is. And for those of you that say, oh, well, if you defend children's right to their biological parent, then you can't say that adoption is okay. Actually, I used to be responsible for compliance for our agency as it related to the international, the federal, and the state level laws about adoption best practice. So I'm pretty familiar with how adoption is supposed to go. Doesn't always go that way. Sometimes people will make it more adult-centric than child-centric, but the principles themselves are geared around the best interest of the child. So what are those best interests? Well, it has to do with making sure the child's needs are met, even if the adult's needs are not met. Those principles have to do with making sure that all the adults that are involved are screened and vetted with significant and exhaustive background checks, with post-placement reports and training and all of that. So, I mean, I am pretty familiar with adoption and how adoption should go. So adoption is a remedy for a broken situation. But what is broken? What's broken is the child has lost their biological mother and father. Now, if you have gone through an adoption as an adoptive parent, you know that it's not very easy to detach a child from their birth mother or their birth father. Sometimes, even if they are have been abusive, even if they are in a chemical treatment center, sometimes they still will not relinquish their parental rights to the child. Why? Because the law presumes that the child belongs with their biological parents. The very fact that it is hard to disconnect a child from their biological parents and then reattach them to a biological stranger testifies to the presumption that biological parents and children belong together. And it is an exception when there is a significant situation of abuse or neglect or tragedy where the child has lost their mom and dad, where they cannot be raised by that man and that woman. So even the very existence of adoption law and the best practice as it is set up now testifies to the fact that biological parents and children belong together and they have a claim to one another. So at Them Before Us, we are very clear. We are some of the most public-facing critics of big fertility, IVF, sperm and egg donation, and surrogacy. That is absolutely incompatible with defending children's right to their mother and father. Adoption is altogether different. In big fertility, adults insist that children lose their rights, their life, or their mother and father, so adults can have what they want. In adoption, it is the adults who do hard things on behalf of children. They are the people, the adults, the adoptive mother and father recognize that the child has experienced a primal wound and they are seeking to mend it. From the child-centric perspective, these are two very different things, and there is nothing about support for adoption that is incompatible with our strong natural law claim that children have a right to their mom and dad.
I was responding to these comments by saying, we've just fielded a bunch of comments the day before that we were too pro-adoption. So what do we say to then the folks that actually are anti-adoption? I think there's a lot of people who've been personally hurt. They feel victimized, like they were ripped away from their family when they shouldn't have been, that their kinship bonds with other family members were not prioritized. How do we respond to the anti-adoption folks? Like you touched on a little bit, there are some ways that it's being done wrong. But the suggestion when I said, what is your answer to just nothing, foster care forever? And she said, no, legal guardianship is the answer. So what would we respond to that?
Well, first of all, adoption begins with loss, significant loss, often primal loss, sometimes loss that can never be fully mended on this side of heaven. Sometimes these children bear the scars of especially birth mother loss all their life. And certainly birth mothers can often mourn the loss of their child all their life. And I do think that especially people on the right who are anti-abortion try to paper over that because they're worried that if they ever talk about the loss or the pain or the downsides of relinquishing a child, it will drive people to abortion. I say, come on, walk and chew gum. You can say that children have a right to their mother and father. You can say children have a right to life, and they also should be with their mother and father whenever possible. And either one of those loss of rights is going to have an impact on the child. So just be honest about how adoption begins with loss. But that doesn't mean that adoptive parents or adoptive children are bad. It means they're mending something that actually matters. I was on a call with somebody who's conservative and pro-life and all of that. And she said, children have a right to a mother and father. And I said, no, children have a right to their mother and father. If children have a right to a mother and father, if any man and woman will do, then actually there's nothing to mourn. When children lose their birth mother, when children go to an orphanage, as long as they're assigned the right mom and dad, then there's no loss there. Why do we cry? Why do we make all these stories about orphans? And then why do they always tend to go looking for their mother and father? It's because there's actually something special about the relationship we have with those two adults that's different from everyone else. We can say that, we should say that, and also say that adoption, when it's properly understood and executed, can be redemptive. And this is the best way for us to work to mend the wound that children have experienced when they're relinquished or when they lose their mom and dad at birth or later on in life. I understand why some people feel hurt by adoption because they've gone through something that no parent or child should ever have to go through, the separation from their mom and dad or from their own child. And in a perfect world, there wouldn't be any of it. We do not live in that world. We live in a world where, for a variety of reasons, tragedy or sometimes adult selfishness forces us to see the child as the client in need of this institution to work according to their best interest and provide them whenever possible with a mom and dad who can seek to heal their wound.
That's so good. That'll preach. And I think it goes to show that it doesn't matter what we say and how many times we say it and how clear we say it. The fact that both sides get irritated with us or think we're saying something that's different kind of goes to show what we talk about with them before us. We are going to piss everyone off at some point. And really, we believe we are being consistent to those underlying things. A child has a right to his or her mother and father that they came from. When that is not possible, then we can look at the best case scenarios and what's best for the children in these other things. And we're going to be consistent on that. We'll post it as many times as we need to, apparently. But thank you for answering that question.
There's been other big news this week that we wanted to talk about. There is a massive case before the Supreme Court, and they heard oral arguments about it on Tuesday. And it has to do with whether or not states are allowed to prohibit biological males from competing in female sports. Jen, you want to give us a rundown on what happened at the Supreme Court?
Yes. So this was the other day. They heard oral arguments on whether states can protect women's sports from biological males who identify as transgender. And the ACLU attorney, so the ACLU, if maybe they did some good things in the past, they are firmly on the side of things that we disagree with now, it feels like. They were representing a trans athlete, or maybe two, that argued that sex should not be defined in this case. They don't want sex defined by the court. They didn't have a definition for it when they were pressed by the justices or by reporters. And the justices, the conservative justices, there's six of them, seemed pretty skeptical of allowing men in women's sports. And there is a ruling expected in the summer. I think things usually drop in June or July. And, you know, outside, as you can imagine, trans activists were attacking and yelling at women who want their spaces protected. I'm personally infuriated that men in women's prisons isn't even a part of this conversation right now. It's horrific what's happening. Our state, Washington, California, women are being physically and sexually abused right now and impregnated by men in women's prisons. I can't believe that in a society that says they care about vulnerable people, that's not part of the conversation. But hopefully a ruling like this can be moved to also protect those women. But yeah, what are your initial thoughts on how the case went? I also have some screenshots here of some of the justices' questions, if we can talk about those. It was pretty interesting.
Oh, that's the whole game, is this question that Alito had for the ACLU lawyer. It all comes down to this. Here they are arguing a case that says that transgender athletes, you know, should be able to play in female sports. And so Justice Alito said, what does it mean to be a man or a woman? That's the whole game, people. If you define that, all these other things answer themselves. And the ACLU lawyer said, we do not have a definition for the court. And Alito goes, He's like, how can a court determine whether there's discrimination on the basis of sex without knowing what sex means? Right. And that, my friends, is the ball game. Like, how are you going to define what discrimination is on the grounds of sex if you can't provide a definition of sex? And they can't. If they were to, somebody would be excluded. And so that is the whole thing about the progressive left. You will notice it is an absolute destruction of all categories. Categories cannot exist in their utopia because categories discriminate. And in their world, discrimination is the great sin, the great evil, right? That means somebody is going to be in and someone's going to be out. And so if everybody's going to be in, there can be no distinctions, there can be no categories. But of course, Jen, as you just pointed out, when we erase those distinctions, there's always victims. And when you erase the distinction between male and female, the victims are women and children, consistently. Women and children. There are no women moving into male prisons, but there are lots of men moving into female prisons. I just heard that about 900 top medals in women's sports around the world have been taken by men over the last couple of years, 900. But there's no women that are winning the Frisbee championship in the male. What do they call the Frisbee thing?
Ultimate Frisbee?
Ultimate Frisbee, right? Like, men are sweeping women's cycling conditions, right? Competitions.
Yeah.
So we're seeing here that when you blur the line, when you destroy categories between male and female, it is women And it is children who are going to pay the price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the ACLU's refusal to define sex while simultaneously arguing sex discrimination exposes their intellectual bankruptcy, right? And Justice Thomas sprung a question on the ACLU lawyer. This was a tweet we saw. He asked for what remedy they want. Like, how do you want us to fix this? And the person, I think, is Strangio, the woman who's pretending to be a man?
Yes. And it's like, can it be any more archetypal? I mean, it's like it's an archetype. Strangio is arguing for acts for destruction of categories. Yeah. She herself has destroyed the category. Her name is Strangio.
When you're listening to her, you just think it's a woman talking, of course, but it presents as a very feminine looking man, facial hair and everything. But okay, what remedy do you want? I think Strangio said an injunction. And Justice Thomas then asked, practically, you get a different treatment based on sex, meaning if a woman wanted to compete with the boys and she was taking testosterone, that could be protected. But if a man competing with men took testosterone, that's illegal because that's basically a steroid, like you're enhancing yourself. He's like, wait, so why are you okay? What's the difference between how we would rule? It's based on the sex of the individual. So, and they are kind of arguing that testosterone cycling is the only thing we can use to look at it. It was very, very just strange.
That's the problem with logic. Biology is the bigot here, people, and it just won't relent. Stay with us. We'll be back with your questions.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another segment here for the comments, here for the commentary between Jen, myself, and Sam, our communications manager. Hey, Sam.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. I'm excited for the few things that we have to talk about today. We'll see if we can even get to them all. But the first topic we wanted to hit was, Sam, what do we say when people, we say, hey, a child has a right to their biological mother and father, the two humans that are responsible for them. That is important to us. That's the absolute ideal. That's why we're against surrogacy. We're against sperm and egg donation. We're against buying and selling human beings. And then people say, well, then you must be against adoption. What do we say to that? Are those exactly the same? Are we against adoption?
No, we are not against adoption. We are pro-adoption. Pro-adoption when it's done right, because there are definitely ways it can be done wrong, which we also will stand with people to fight against those ways. But when it's done right, the whole point is to help the child, not create a child with a situation that's already broken, but it's finding a broken child situation and fixing it. And so we are definitely pro-adoption.
That's right. And we actually wrote a Substack that we can link to in the show notes here that we go through, I think, about four or five reasons. Adoption and third party reproduction, when you need a third party to help you reproduce, these things are not the same. And the major point is that one, adoption, the institution, is responding to a child's loss. The other institution, big fertility, third party reproduction, is actually creating child loss. So let's just go through some of these main points here that Katie lays out in our Substack article. You can go to thembeforeus.substack.com, subscribe for free and get access to a ton of our materials, become a paid subscriber and get access to all of our materials, including our subscriber chat. But the first point is adoption seeks to mend a wound and third-party reproduction inflicts a wound. Can you talk about, like, give us some examples about third party inflicting a wound on children.
Yeah. So any time that you separate a child from one of their biological parents, that's inherently inflicting a wound. So whether that's donor conception, where the person, you know, donates sperm or donates an egg, and they don't even know if a child is being created out of that, and then a child is created out of that and never gets to meet that parent, that inherently inflicts a wound on a child, because every child, every person wonders where they came from and who their parents are. are and who they look like and what kind of diseases may run in their family, or does their laugh sound like their parents' laugh? And so anytime you steal that away from a child and not know just because you want a child, that's inflicting a wound.
Yeah, some people have even called this the primal wound. There was a book written by Nancy Verrier. I'm probably saying that wrong, probably kind of French. The Primal Wound, Understanding the Adopted Child, which I think was written in, I'm not sure, I want to say the 80s or some, no, sorry, 2010 she wrote a follow-up to it, actually. So before 2010, quite a while ago. And a lot of people then want to debunk that book and say, no, there's a lot of things in there that aren't helpful, not scientific. But actually, patient Sunny, who's an employee, a colleague of ours as well, she and I did a podcast episode, I believe, and wrote an article. So it's linked in our Substack post about the primal womb. Hey, let's revisit it and see what does the data say. And we know that maternal separation matters to children. Again, these are things that matter and are agreed upon, unless you're talking about gay men wanting to buy a child with surrogacy, or a single dad wanting to buy a child with surrogacy, or that perfect Christian heterosexual couple that wants to use, my sister is going to do it for free and give us a baby and use a surrogate. Well, guess what? The baby loses mom at birth. And that is a wound for children. It's a wound for monkeys. It's a wound for rats. Things we were actually allowed to study because it's so unethical. You can't even study it for humans, but we can do it for $100,000. So the primal wound is a thing. Maternal separation is a thing. I loved in our article, Katie says, adoption says, let me help. Third-party reproduction says, let me have.
Yes. Yeah. And it feels like it should be focused on the child. They should come first. That should be our primary focus as a society, is the well-being and the rights of a child being uplifted. But also, it's also a wound for the mother. And there are women who will be out there and saying like, oh no, I could be a surrogate and it wouldn't hurt me to grow a baby in me and give them away. But that's just not healthy for humans. It's not healthy for women. What we know about pregnancy and what we know about motherhood is that being with your baby after birth is what's good for women. And so even if we want to focus on the women instead of the children, it's not good for women either. Same for men. It's not good for men to just give up children either. We all agree that deadbeat dads are the worst. It's like that's you should not be abandoning your child. So just walking down the street and going into a clinic to make a few bucks and donating some sperm, which really means being paid for giving that away. And that's not good for men either. So overall, as a society, this is a loss for us all. It's not just about the child, but that should be our primary concern.
Yeah, that's so good. Yeah, we're against deadbeat dads unless he calls himself a sperm donor, apparently.
Yeah.
That's now acceptable in society. Here's the next point. With adoption, the child is the client. And like you're saying, when adoption, when properly understood, is a good and redemptive thing, it can be done incorrectly. But when it's done right, the child's the client. In third-party reproduction, the adult is the client. Think about commissioning a product that you want. And with the advent of technology, with our ability to genetically screen, I think there's some that are claiming they can screen for eye color already. We know they can screen for gender. We know you can screen for ethnicity. There's some, you know, promises, hey, I'm looking for a particular sperm donor. He's 6'5" and he went to Harvard or has this level of IQ. Okay, well, I'm going to use that sperm donor. So of course, when adults are the client and you're paying a woman to host your baby for you, and she gets cancer and she wants to deliver the baby early so she can get chemo and your baby's going to go into the NICU. I don't want a partially developed product for the $100,000 I paid. And these are real life stories that are happening where a surrogate is being told you aren't allowed to get chemo and you're not allowed to deliver the baby early because we don't want our product messed with. You need to abort it basically and start over because we paid you.
Yep. Yeah, again, it's just commodifying children. These are human beings. These are children. And these children have a mom and a dad. And it's not just who pays for them. They have a biological mother and father who they belong to. And so, again, we as adults need to focus on their rights and their well-being. And we know that children have a right to their mom and their dad.
The next point that we make is in adoption, the adult supports the child. And I don't know if you know any adoptive families. I can think of a few that the parents are working hard, enduring a lot of pain and discomfort to facilitate relationship with birth families, traveling, hosting, dealing with things when a parent flakes, when something happens, when the kid comes back and is upset, working really hard to put themselves on the back burner and support their child when things are hard within the adoption context, right? In third-party reproduction, the child often has to support the adult. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, because it's, again, they get to decide what kind of child they have. They get to select different things. And then the child often has to sacrifice for them because they have to sacrifice a relationship with their biological father or their biological mother a lot of the times. And oftentimes, I believe with like, I don't know if it's IVF or surrogacy or both, it's like 50% of that is done by gay couples. So you're not only sacrificing a relationship with your biological dad, but any dad at all. And you just have two moms or vice versa. And so again, you're making the child give up things that are extremely important for them developmentally and just as a human being, because that's what you want. And so if you are going into parenthood saying, what do I want? And making the child sacrifice for you, that's the wrong way to go into parenthood. When you go into parenthood, your first thought always should be, what is best for my child? What can I do to help them grow and be nurtured correctly and develop correctly and give them a happy, fulfilling life?
Yeah, one of the quotes from a donor conceived, I don't know if it's a man or a woman, but says basically, no matter how awesome my mom is, I will think about the siblings with my same donor's blood running through their veins. No matter how awesome my mom is, I will still not have the courage to tell her that I found my biological father. Like many other donor conceived offspring, through nothing more than a few Google searches, she can never know that I felt unhappy enough to the point where she, the one who paid thousands of dollars to bring me into this world, is not enough to satisfy me. Children at all the various ages, on Anonymous Us, some of these are teenagers, some are college age, some are adults with their own families, basically share an almost universal feeling of, I have to hold all of this longing, any shame I feel, any grief I feel, I have to hold it on my own because the parent that chose to do this to me can't handle it, that I have a problem with it. And we talk about a study called My Daddy's Name is Donor. It's studying a large group of kids conceived by sperm donors. And they have worse outcomes than kids who've been adopted. So no biological connection. And I've been adopted by strangers. Better outcomes than kids who've been donor conceived, even when they're with at least one biological parent, which the article will go into all those reasons. But a big piece of it is you're with the adult a lot of the time who chose to do this to you.
Yeah. When an adopted child asks their adoptive parents, hey, where are my mom and dad? And how come they didn't want me? Or how come I can't be near them? They have to explain a broken situation, which is truly heartbreaking. But a lot of the time, it's a little bit more understanding. You know, they were too young to raise a kid, or, you know, they have this addiction. And so that wasn't safe for you to be there. And they knew that. And they were giving you to someone so you could be safe. And when you talk to a donor conceived child and they say, where's my biological father? Why can't I have a relationship with him? That parent has to say, oh, I paid him to not know you. I specifically gave him money saying, I don't want you in their life. I just want you to help me create them. And then I don't even want to tell them your name or anything about you. And if you contact us, a lot of the times there's like legal issue with that. They specifically cut that person off and you're the perpetrator of this trauma.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. The final point we make with our last few minutes here is that adoption is sometimes necessary. We talk about Them Before Us. If we could restore marriage to the proper understanding, it's one man, one woman, It's complementary, meaning male, female, monogamous, just the two of them, exclusive. We're not adding in anybody else. And it's for life. If we had that, and the majority of people did that, almost every social issue disappears, right? But we would still have tragedy. We'd still have an accident. We'd still have cancer. Children would still lose a mom or dad or both from the things that are just unavoidable. And so adoption will still be necessary, even if society otherwise had everything together, right? And the difference is third-party reproduction is never necessary. There is no reason for sperm donation, egg donation, or to use surrogates other than adult desire, adults saying, I want a child by any means necessary. I don't want to go through adoption screenings for it. And I have a check that can clear, and therefore I can have a child. And that's the only reason for it, right? To quote unquote infertility, and I want what I want, and I'm going about it the way I want it. And so we're against it. It inflicts brokenness 100% of the time. There's no reason for it. And adoption needs to be understood properly. And there is a reason for it. It's a just society's response to a child that's already lost something.
Yep. And adoption, it is evidence and it is proof that children have a right to their biological parents, because that's how every child starts their lives, with their biological mother and being related to their biological father. And those are the two people that inherently have a right to those children. So when something goes wrong and those parents can't be the ones to care for them, that's when we have to get in there with adoption and find a safe home for them. But, you know, we don't just birth children and just throw them out in the world and say, whatever couple's free, you can take the child. It's like, no, they always go to their parents first, unless something's wrong, proving that that's who they have a right to.
Right. We talk about that analogy. If you're in the hospital and you have a baby, do you care which baby you go out with? I mean, if they just line them all up and then they said, well, this one is probably on track to be the tallest. You want the tallest one or the shortest one? And they just hand you a random baby on the way out of the hospital. It's ludicrous on its face. Nobody thinks that's okay. Nobody thinks that as long as the child is loved, that it won't matter. Well, all the child needs is love. Why do you care which kid you walk out of the hospital with? Everyone knows that's not true. Okay, with our final 30 seconds, where should people find us? Where's the best way to see all the fun tea about Them Before Us?
Substack and Twitter, Them Before Us. You can also find us on Instagram and Facebook.
Get into those comments, everyone. It's so fun. We enjoy it. Sam and I like replying. We send them into the group chats when things are just so unhinged. I mean, most of the crude, gross ones are hidden at this point, but I still get to enjoy them, blocking people and such. But yeah, go to find us on all of our social media. Follow us. Thanks so much for listening to the podcast or the YouTube video or however you're seeing us today. And we will catch you guys next time.
All right. See ya.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.